Chapter 3, Your Lucky, Lucky Career. In my early 20s, when I was trying to find my passion and purpose, I worked for a few months as a telemarketer in a call center, and this was indeed a crappy and boring job, especially for someone like me who values freedom above all else. So within a couple of weeks, I was the number 2 salesperson in the company, and I probably could have been number 1 without much more effort, but I decided to quit. So that was just lucky, right? You know, either that or I was a naturally good salesperson. Nope, none of the above. I actually completely rigged the system. Our shift hours at the call center were 5 p.m. to 9 p.m. For 4 hours, we had to constantly make cold calls to people who were at home to convince them to buy a broadband internet service that they didn't want. And if you've ever done telemarketing, you know how demoralizing it is hearing no over and over and over again, especially when you just want to help people. So we got a couple of inbound calls during that time, but mostly we're making outbound calls. We were calling people. But when those calls came in, it was a fight to answer the call as quickly as possible because those calls were all warm leads with a much higher probability of a sign up. So one evening, I decided to stay back an hour and see how many of those calls came in after quitting time. So when everyone else clocked off to go to the pub at 9 o'clock, I stayed around for a little bit and I answered every single one of those inbound calls. And it was usually someone who had just seen an ad on TV or they've just been on the company website and they were just calling to ask a few questions and just to sign up. And guess who took those signups? Me. So that became my routine. I would half-heartedly make cold calls for 4 hours, or I'd pretend to do it. Bad, I know, and I would maybe get one sign up, and then I would work just one extra hour after everyone went home. That extra hour was unpaid, of course, but my commissions made up for it. Plus, I got the recognition and reward for being a top salesperson. So there's a big lesson in that. It's okay to take shortcuts. Now, I'm aware that it doesn't sound particularly 100% ethical. After all, wasn't I hired to cold call for 4 hours? Well, no, if you look at it, I was actually hired to get sales for the company, and I just became very creative about how I achieved that. The thing was, their preferred way was actually a colossal waste of time and energy, and I quickly discovered their secret. It was actually probably cheaper to hire a bunch of young people like us than it was to spend more money on advertising or a better product. You see, most traditional careers are absolute crap and actually designed to create more work for us. So the secret is to find out the cheat in everyday life and your luck is just going to hit the roof. As Earl Wilson says, success is simply a matter of luck. Just ask any failure. And that's what people would have thought. Oh, Denise, lucky bitch, you know, doing so well at work. Not at all. So lucky people, they work to their strengths. If you've ever struggled to find your purpose and passion, I bet you, $100, you actually already know what it is. Sometimes it's the easiest and most obvious answer. It's cheating the system again, but this time in a good way, because why make things difficult for yourself when you can do what comes most naturally to you? I spent my 20s desperately trying to find my purpose. I read countless books, like Poe Bronson's book, which was What Should I Do With My Life? And I took far too many personality tests. However, the clues were always right in front of me. All I had to do was look at my childhood. So I forced myself to be on the debate team, even though I was scared of public speaking. And then one of my first jobs was talking on stage for children's shows. And then my favorite present was the electric typewriter I got for my 9th birthday. I was always starting new clubs and creative projects to make extra money. And I remember when I was 12, we moved into a house and it had a blackboard in my bedroom. And I thought this was fantastic. So I started giving lectures to my brother and my cousin Rick, and they weren't having any of it. But I loved it. So all of that points to leader, creator, entrepreneur, mentor, coach, speaker, and writer. Funnily enough, everything that I do now. But it took me forever for me to make that my career because it felt too easy and obvious and scary. I actually didn't want to screw up what was so important to me. So that's an interesting journal experiment, is to write down what you liked to do when you were a child. What activities did you like to do? What things did you naturally do? As a child, I thought that being a proper grown-up meant working in an office all day, wearing a suit with big shoulder pads, remember it was the 80s, and sitting at a desk in front of a computer. And that's exactly what I ended up with when I went into my career. But experience soon showed me that the other parts of corporate life, you know, the meetings, the bureaucracy, and the lack of autonomy, and that didn't suit me at all. So I went looking for alternatives where I could still use those skills, but in a way that suited my natural preferences better. And of course, I'll continue to tweak as I go. Nothing is ever set in stone. No career you go into is permanent for the rest of your life. We all have the ability to change our mind all the time if we want. In fact, this is necessary. So, for example, I went into coaching and then I realized I prefer to meet with my clients over Skype or phone than face to face. So I changed my coaching offerings so it suited my natural strengths. So here's a question for you, gorgeous. Are you working to your natural strengths? And you might not believe it at the moment, but it is entirely possible to find that perfect collision of your natural strengths and a proper job or business that people will pay you money to do. And I'm entirely serious. If your imagination can think it up, it can usually be monetized. Trust me. So in a recent coaching session, my client mentioned how much she loved her job. She organized holiday respite care for people with disabilities, but she was increasingly frustrated about where she lived in Australia. So she loved a job, but her life wasn't working for her. And she'd just come home from 2 years living in Canada, and she was desperate to get back to that winter lifestyle. So her dream was mountains, not beaches. And although she'd never lived there, something in her heart told her that Switzerland was the place to go. So she wanted to quit everything and go be a ski bum in Europe. But she was frustrated because her saving was taking so long, you know, saving money. And she was worried about finding a job when the competition was so fierce, even for those lowly paid ski jobs. And part of her kind of felt like it wasn't a real job. She felt like what she was doing now was her real life and she was going to run away from it and be a ski bum for a little bit. So together, we looked at what was really important to her and how she could have both of these things in her life, a career she loved and the freedom and adventure she craved. So I asked her if she realized that there were organizations that arrange skiing holidays for disabled people. And she'd never thought about it before. It seemed too easy. No more angst. The solution was perfect. And with her experience and personal passion, experience in working with people with disabilities and personal passion about skiing, it shouldn't be too hard for her to find a job. She almost couldn't believe that it could come together so perfectly. It doesn't have to be one thing or the other. But why couldn't she come up with that solution herself? In hindsight, it was completely obvious. You know, even as I'm saying it to you, you might be thinking, well, duh. But she almost needed permission from somebody else to live a life that was perfectly suited to her as a whole person. And we're used to separating our lives into segments. You know, there's your passion and maybe the thing you have to do for money. A perfect example is to take a perfectly normal job and combine it with a passion. And here are some really cool examples of people that I know. So my cousin works in motocross and she told me that Motocross Australia hire a lot of chaplains, you know, people who are priests and chaplains. And I thought, wow, how amazing is that? If you are a chaplain and you love motocross, you can combine those two loves. What about people who are hairdressers and beauticians on cruise ships? You have your love of beauty and your love of travel. Or what about someone who is a seamstress but loves cabaret? Well, you can be a seamstress for a cabaret show. It's really obvious. A friend of mine is a bookkeeper, but she's a bookkeeper for a private island. So she can go and travel and stay on the private island. And so many people believe that work isn't meant to be fun. In fact, there's almost this strong belief that, quote unquote, everybody hates their jobs, right? Or that we have no choice. There are bills to pay. You know, hating your job is just a part of life. And I've been told this many, many times by friends and even well-meaning relatives. When the ultimate job competition and the travel extravaganza are finished, we were told with almost undisguised glee, oh, you're going to have to go back to the real world now, won't you? As if we were living this fantasy life and now life would be shit again. No way. We used that experience as motivation to completely change the way we lived. And eventually we ended up moving to Australia instead of going back to our dull grey flat in London. So guess what, gorgeous? The real world, it can be awesome. And then there's the guilt, right? So after all, we're told life isn't meant to be easy. You work, you pay your bills, and then you die. How lovely is that? And many of my clients tell me the guilt they feel about out-earning their parents, especially for work that comes easily to them. One client spoke of her dad getting up at dawn every day and working physically hard all day for minimum wage. It therefore seems almost obscene for her to make good money as a coach. After all, she wasn't working with her hands or creating anything visibly tangible. She was quote unquote talking to people over the phone. So it kind of felt unseemly somehow making good money for that. And I understand. My own mother, she worked many jobs when I was growing up as a cleaner, a secretary, a waitress. Now she's an assistant nurse. So she works long hours with the sick, elderly, and disabled. And although she mostly loves her work, it takes a lot out of her physically. And I was embarrassed to tell her that I could probably make her daily wage in 1 hour. It felt unfair, but I realized I couldn't hold myself back any longer, and she was actually really proud of me. You're probably going to have to get over the fact that you will earn more than your parents, and for something that you love as well. So here's a question for you, gorgeous. Are you unconsciously limiting your income to appease other people? It's a big question. The very easiest way to have luck in your business or career is to do something that you love. And I know this can be an incredibly overused cliche. When I was working one of my cubicle jobs, I remember reading a book called Do What You Love and the Money Will Follow by, I think her name's Marsha Sinitar or something. But I was like, when, mofo, when will the money come? And the problem was that I completely misunderstood this mantra. I had started doing things for money, not because I thought they were a good idea, not because of the love of it. So the money never showed up. My heart just wasn't in it. My first real online business was actually helping women to lose weight for their wedding using raw food. And I thought it was a great idea. It was called Raw Brides. And I talk about it a lot almost as a way of showing that something could be a really good idea. It could be an interesting niche, but this was a problem for several reasons. Firstly, I'm not that into weddings. And secondly, I'm not an expert in health. I was great at helping women overcome their barriers to good health, but weddings, oh my God, bore the hell out of me. And isn't that ironic, right, that I got married over 80 times and weddings bore me? But just because you're good at something, it doesn't mean you have to do it for a living, especially if your heart's not in it. Now, I've got lots of skills. I used to be a jack of all trades. I'm an excellent event manager, but my heart's no longer working behind the scenes. It's working on stage and being the CEO of my business, not the person doing it. So it's okay to evolve and change. So despite the fact that I've been joyfully writing, speaking, mentoring, and creating from such a young age, why did it take me so long to make it my career? Here's the thing. I was afraid. I was afraid of people telling me I was too young, too uneducated, the wrong kind of background, too fat, not pretty enough. And that fear causes real physical pain. Doing what I love now is really freaking awesome. I love helping women be brave, do things that scare them, create businesses, and live inspired lives. But I'll be honest, doing my own work still scares me. Yes, it scares me to death, but it's so much better than trying to fit into the mold of working for somebody else. A quote from James Garfield, "A pound of pluck is worth a ton of luck." And I love that quote because it's also like, you just have to have the guts sometimes to do it. That's worth more than any luck that could come to you. Writing this book, oh my God, it caused me so many shuddering, nervous breakdowns and tears, real tears. I was so scared to do it. So even though I spent a lot of time writing for my website, I don't actually think of myself that much as a proper writer. And probably because I did business studies at university instead of doing, you know, something like being a journalist. So I would be thinking, what if it's shit? What if people hate it? Oh my God, it's terrible. No one's going to buy this. Oh my God, I'm going to throw up if anyone even does buy it. Because what if they hate it? Yes, everybody goes through fear. You are not alone and you know that. I constantly have to work on my feelings of fear because I'm always pushing myself to try something new. I'm never ever complacent. Fear just means that you are constantly growing. I really wish I could tell you there was a magic pill that makes everything awesome all the time, but it's not true. I've included many examples of creative people in this section, not because I don't work with people in corporate jobs, but I found that a conventional job, it's not as emotionally and spiritually challenging sometimes in our society. After all, you can get up and you can do a job that you mildly dislike and you can collect your salary without stress. However, I've noticed, especially for women, especially when we go out of our comfort zone and we really endeavor to earn money from our innate talents and abilities, all hell can break loose. It can bring up all of your worst insecurities and fears about yourself. Fears like being broke and homeless. So even if you don't fit into the following categories, just see what you can learn from them. And I'm going to start with some of the people after my own heart. It's the dancers, singers, and actors. So the reason why I start with these people is because I did tap, jazz, and ballet lessons from when I was about 8. And I took to it really, really easily. I loved it. And soon I was dancing almost every day after school. And every weekend I was performing in local competitions and virtually anywhere our dance teacher could find a stage. I mean, shopping centres, festivals and retirement homes. She pimped us out everywhere and she gave us such a great work ethic. And I want you to think about this in context of something you might have done as a kid too. So a sporting thing that you did or music lessons or whatever, something that you just got obsessed by. But I never actively pursued professional dancing as a career because I was convinced that I was too short and had the wrong body type. So I had that in my mind from the start. You know who is the exact same height as me? Madonna and Britney Spears. So I'm not saying that I was good enough to perform professionally, but who knows what I could have accomplished with the desire and hope. But I completely cut off the possibility with that belief that I was too short. My friend Paul Kay is a professional dancer and he's performed regularly on cruise ships and touring shows since he was about 17 when we met. We were actually in a show together called Bugs Bunny and the Pirates. And what most people don't know about Paul is that he had a car accident when he was 14 and it left him with severe leg injuries. And he still has trouble a little bit fully pointing his toe on that leg, but he disguises it extremely well through good technique and hard work. So if you saw him bare-legged, you would notice his scars. And he does have a slight limp when he's tired, but he's an amazing performer. And you would only know this if you knew Paul really, really well. And I've heard people say to Paul that he works regularly because he's a guy and he's good-looking. You know, that's a big excuse. Oh, it's easy for guys. But trust me, Paul could have had a great excuse for not being a professional dancer. He's also extremely dedicated to his technique and physical appearance, which is imperative to that industry. But many of his friends who don't work as regularly, they pass Paul's career off as luck. And Paul has never thought of anything else. Like there was no plan B for him. He was going to be a professional dancer. There are a lot of dance schools where I grew up, but you know, it's weird. Not all of the most beautiful or talented dancers made it. Some did it through sheer hard work and determination. And one of those local success stories is a guy called Joshua Horner. And Australians might know him as one of the judges on Dancing with the Stars. So he comes from my local area. And everyone watching him at our local Estedfords, we knew he was amazing. I mean, everyone would stop and just watch him. But there were others just as good, mainly women, because he was one of the only guys. I mean, the girls there who were just as good as him, who seemed destined to succeed, but they didn't. Josh won a grant to attend the Australian Ballet and he's danced in many productions. He's been in Billy Elliot, I think for the Academy Awards he was in Billy Elliot, that little montage, and Moving Out, the Billy Joel musical I think it's called. And then he worked at Disneyland for a choreographer, which was his dream job, and then he got his big break as a judge on the Australian production of Dancing with the Stars. So not bad for a local boy from the Central Coast. But you know what? Just luck, right? No freaking way. So Josh said in a recent newspaper article, he said, people say to me, you're so lucky, Josh. And I really want to slap them. I'm not lucky. I planted all of those seeds and I planned my career out. I really listened to what I wanted to do and I never let anybody stop me. And I know Josh quite well and I asked him if he'll be an upcoming lucky bitch of the month. So, and I'm actually going to go see him next week in a chorus line on stage. But you know what? There were plenty of talented dancers in our area who had the same opportunity and same training as Josh, but he's the one who made it happen. He was auditioning all the time. He was working on his craft. He fixed up his spotty skin. He used to have bad skin and he took medication for it and he made it happen. He networked. He made his own YouTube videos. And you know what? Nothing like that. It doesn't happen by accident. It doesn't. So what's the lesson here? It's, what are your excuses for not living your dreams? And I've got a great example here. So talk about turning your shortcomings into an advantage. Megan Davies, she is an accomplished dancer. She's an actor, singer, and voiceover artist. And I've worked with her before in shows. And she's also extremely petite. So she's just under 5 feet tall. And I asked her to give some insights into her own words about, you know, having something like that that could have been a shortcoming that she turned into an advantage. So I said, have you ever had people like friends, family, and teachers tell you that you couldn't be a performer? She said, it's interesting. I was fairly insecure as a child. I had a dance teacher who made me feel as small as an ant. But then didn't we all? In a way, it made me more determined to prove myself. My parents encouraged me, and I don't ever remember telling me to sit down and get a real job. And I asked her if she ever used her height to her advantage. And she said, anything that makes us different can be a weakness or a strength. It's usually a weakness if you listen to your detractors. However, if you have the courage inside, you realize that your differences are what makes you stand out from the crowd, and this knowledge can be quite powerful. Being just under 5 foot has certainly lost me a lot of roles that I'd be considered for if I was just a few inches taller. But yet at the same time, it's helped me find some pretty incredible people and to let them remember me. I don't think that without all the other ingredients, persistence, talent, and professionalism, my height, it just wouldn't have helped me. But with these qualities, it's certainly given me my own little niche. In a small industry like the Australian arts industry, sometimes I think I'd rather fit in with the chorus line, so to speak. But when a role comes up that's just a little bit left of center, it really seems to have my name on it. And I'll give you a little bit of inside stuff here. So Megan and I met when we were in a show together called The Cushion Kids. It was like this really random little show and we were all different types of cushions. They were like cushions who came alive. And I was grumpy cushion or something and she was a baby cushion and it was this tiny, tiny little cushion. And she got that role because it called for an artist who was really super tiny. And that's where she, and she's even sometimes goes in roles where she plays little kids. It's amazing. So I asked her, why do you think that some people with talent and the looks don't necessarily make it? You know, do your friends who are performers have any particular commonalities? And she said, yeah, sometimes I would say the people with the looks do make it. And those with the talent, they just have to work a lot harder if they don't have the looks. And it's a shame, really. You hear some amazing singers doing solo sets down the road, and then you hear some very, very average singers in concert charging hundreds of dollars a pop. It'd be nice if society could get past looks. After all, you don't need to be a supermodel to be a lawyer, a teacher, or a politician. But surely it's great to see a whole lot of different types of people represented on our screens. But I do think a lot of it comes down to sheer determination and getting that break. You look back at the group of people you studied with at university, and some of them have gone on very successfully into other fields. Sometimes I think people just wake up and realize they spend a lot of time dreaming and working in the arts, but not a lot of time doing it. And it's not easy at all. When you love something, you want to do it as much as possible. Imagine a lawyer studying for years to become a lawyer, but yet only getting an opportunity to practice a few times a year. And in those few times, they might eventually realize that without all the downtime and the very little work time, it's not actually worth it. So I think you really have to want it. And I think you have to be willing to sacrifice a lot for it. A decent paycheck, a normal life, security, and so on. And I'm not intending to paint a bleak picture, but it is what it is. You need to do it because you love it. It's what gets you out of bed in the morning. Otherwise, I think it's too tough. Talent and looks is not even close to being enough. There will always be someone more attractive, more suited to a particular role, and there's a lot more to it. And I asked her if she'd had any particularly lucky breaks that she felt were divinely guided or just from the right place at the right time. She said, yes, absolutely. It's quite serendipitous when I look at how I've gotten to work with a certain person. They might have seen me in a show that I almost didn't do. I might be in the right city at the right place at a certain time that helped me run into someone who knows someone that I know. And not many lucky breaks just come from having your CV and headshots out there. Often when you think you've just had enough, you get a call from your agent from a job that you are so excited to do. And that's what keeps you going. It's what keeps you hanging in there. It reminds you of why you do what you do. And I asked Megan if she ever struggled to get paid well for doing what she loves. She says there's not a lot of money in the arts in this country, which is Australia. And it's unfortunate. It really limits how great the work can be. There comes a time also when an actor needs to start treating their work like a business. The craft is an art. But to run any business, you need to get paid. And I think it's imperative that we don't undervalue ourselves. I have trained for many, many years to have the skills I have. I started dancing when I was 3. I learned several musical instruments and I attended back-to-back dance classes, singing classes, acting classes, university, took additional workshops around the world. These skills make me the performer I am today. And actors are continually asked to work for deferred pay. When the project is great, the team is inspiring, of course I'll consider it. However, sometimes you need to step back and say, who is gaining here? Is this my personal project or is it someone else's? Is it me or is it them who should be taking the financial risk? Can I work for nothing again? And the answer is sometimes okay, and the answer is sometimes no. I asked her if there was anything else she wanted to add for any aspiring actors, dancers, whatever, in the arts. And she says, we are our own barriers to success. The older I get, the less energy I have to take big risks and the less brave I become. And I'm starting to challenge this concept again. The best moments in my life have been due to taking risks, of stepping outside my comfort zone. And I've always said, if you walk into a casting and you don't believe you belong there, that you can do the job, then why on earth would the casting director believe in you? The easiest way to achieve something is just to stop thinking about it and actually get out there and do it. Success should be a verb. And I love that. And I just want to say thank you again to Megan for sharing that, because she's a perfect example of someone who just goes out there and works and gets it done so she can work in the area that she loves. This next section is for artists, sculptors, or any other creative types. And the starving artist mentality is just so alive and well in our generation, just as it has persisted for centuries. And what's the freaking deal with that? Seriously, who decided that it's a sellout to actually get paid for your contribution to the world in a creative way? So I asked for a few comments from a business coach and art marketing consultant who is Freya L. Sarti, and she helps visual artists build that sustainable business meant to stand the test of time. So I asked her to share some thoughts on luck and artistic success. So I said, with the artists you work with, what do you think differentiates those who make it and those who don't? And she said the main determining factor in artists who make it is the artist's ability to follow their creativity, to encompass all aspects of their career, not just when it comes to producing their work. They have a willingness to be flexible, to learn new skills, and to do whatever is necessary to bring their dream to full fruition. This means taking full responsibility for their success and taking full control of their future. Success can be defined in a variety of ways, so I think it's important to define what making it means. I mean that they can comfortably support themselves financially with their creative business, and in addition, they feel a sense of life fulfillment due to their commitment to their own personal core values. So I asked her what those attributes would be, and here's what she said, and this relates to anyone. It doesn't matter if you're not in a particularly creative field. So she said, they realize the importance of investing them in themselves in terms of time, energy, and money. They know how to leverage their time, energy, and resources so they get the highest return on investment when they're engaged in business activities. They have a clear vision and strategic plan for following through. They work within the realm of their strengths and they delegate their weaknesses. They're resourceful and persistent. They value themselves and their work or services. They're committed to integrity, courage, and perseverance. And they're fully committed to making a difference in the world or their community or city. And lastly, and I really like this, they move forward constantly, accepting that they will make mistakes and knowing that when they do, it's not a big deal. And they'll just learn from them and expand like ever before. And as I said, that doesn't just relate to people in the creative industries. This is any industry. But how can artists overcome that starving artist mentality and earn a decent wage for their work? So Freya says, first, you have to identify any limiting factors that hold you back from pricing your artwork fairly. If you're not sure what fair is, get help from somebody. And a really good consultant won't tell you what price to put on your work, but they'll help you develop the skills and confidence to price your own work with integrity. And again, this relates to any industry. Next, you have to identify any limiting beliefs about money in general and any financial success. If there are any obstacles, you have to identify whether they're internal or external, and most are internal. And then when you have a grasp on your constraints, you might have to develop necessary skills, acquire needed knowledge, and do any spiritual or physiological work needed to shift those constraints. If you start working on any other business endeavors first without removing those obstacles in the way of you building a sustainable business or making a comfortable living from your art, then you're going to waste precious energy and resources. So working through this process first will save you years of hard work. And I'm really glad she said that because that is my philosophy exactly. Declutter everything first and then it will be so much easier. And I wanted to ask if she had any stories about artists who just seem really lucky and what makes them lucky. So she said one of her artists, Ginger Markley, who was a sculptor, who she had this amazing privilege of taking a class with a world famous sculptor called Jean Pearson. And during this one class, Ginger learned a specific technique which transformed her work almost overnight. And luck, or a little bit of both, who knows, but this one event changed the course of Ginger's entire life and career. One thing can sometimes make that difference. And then another person, Seal Lorenzen, founder of eMesh Organic Body Products. So she was granted the opportunity to travel around the world learning from Indigenous women about how to craft natural botanicals into healing products. But without that clear vision, she wouldn't have been able to learn about that opportunity to learn this dying skill from the masters. Without this lucky experience, Seal would not have held that sacred wisdom that she now infuses into all her offerings, because there's a lot of people who sell those kind of things. But once she had that knowledge, her product line exploded because it was very niched and she could barely keep up with the idea for new products. Another person, Marn Jane, who is a painter of African animals, had the good luck of being invited to contribute to the Academy Award gift bags. Now that's a pretty amazing opportunity, but some people would have to turn that kind of thing down because they weren't ready. And that kind of lucky opportunity leads sales down the road. And for the life of her career, that just kept on coming in, referral after referral. But in each of those cases, what's made this artist really lucky was the fact that they had a really clear vision of where their careers were going and a strategic plan, which we can all learn from. Where are you going? And how are you going to recognize those opportunities when they come up for what they are? And although these examples, they couldn't predict those opportunities that would come to them, but they had that clarity in what allowed things to naturally unfold. And then it feels like you're in the right place at the right time. But in every case, luck was manifested with action, will, and confidence. So the last group is my favorite, right? The writers, coaches, and entrepreneurs. But every single piece of advice that we've talked about so far with these creatives and dancers and all this kind of thing, it relates to you too. And I hope you didn't skip that bit because you're not a dancer or an actor or an artist, because every creative profession has that danger of being vulnerable. So forget about that voice in your head that says you can't make a real business or living out of your talent. It doesn't matter what your excuses are, too young, too old, too fat, too something. One of my clients, Laura, is about 26, and she's actually starting to do a little bit of coaching on the side of her job with a view to one day making it a full-time vocation. And she told me that she was really deflated at a recent event because this 40-something woman told her that she didn't have enough life experience to be an effective coach. And some of you might have heard that before. And is that true? Is because she's 26, does that mean that she won't be a good coach? Well, it kind of depends, right? But chances are the clients that she will attract will be the ones who will resonate with her particular skills and experience, and she'll be able to offer real value. But if she waits until someone else deems that she's ready, chances are she'll never be ready, right? So what are your excuses? Too young, too old, not ready? That exact same thing that happened to Laura happened to me, but it came from my landlord of all people. So when he was showing us around our apartment, he asked me what I did for a living. I said, I'm a life coach and a writer. And his response was, oh, you're a bit too young for that, aren't you? And my silent response back to him was, well, how old do I have to be? You know, if I was too young in my 20s and now I'm too old in my 30s, well, when is ever going to be the right time? And you know what? You don't have to know all the answers now. And I don't as a coach. I don't have to know all the answers, but I can ask great questions. Now, it doesn't matter what you want to do in your career, but every professional and entrepreneurial endeavor, it kind of has this apprenticeship built in where you have to might give your services away for free, or you might have to take on other work to pay your bills. There's a learning curve in anything, in any profession, and it might take you hundreds of hours in unpaid grift before it pays off. The problem is, gorgeous, that there's just no rule book to tell you exactly what you need to complete that apprenticeship. And sadly, most people give up well before they can start to taste some of the success. A quote from Elbert Hubbard is, luck is the tenacity of purpose. J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter, it famously got rejected by 12 publishers. But seriously, that's nothing. Gone with the Wind by Margaret Mitchell, that was rejected 38 times. Would you have given up earlier than these women did? So do you want to be published? How many manuscripts have you honestly sent out in the last 6 months? How many? Have you gotten and implemented any feedback about what you can improve about your idea? Have you treated each rejection as one step in your apprenticeship? Or have you kind of given up thinking, oh, I'm just unlucky? Or maybe you've kind of worried that your work was no good? So luckily, Thomas Edison didn't take his repeated failures personally. He was just trying to solve a problem of producing a workable light bulb. And the challenge of it was probably incredibly exciting for him. So what if you could face your career in the same way? What if publishing a book or making a living from your website was just a satisfyingly tricky problem to solve and nothing more? Certainly, it's not a reflection of your worth as a person. It's just a tricky problem to solve. A great quote from Aaron Alston, luck consists largely of hanging on by your fingernails until things start to go your way. So give yourself permission to dream. It's never, ever too late to pursue your childhood dream. Even if you don't make it your full-time career, you'll still get enormous satisfaction out of doing what you love. So write, dance, create, sell, teach, inspire. It's never too late, gorgeous. So there are no excuses.